Good morning. One who comes from Milwaukee almost hesitates to show himself in public. Glad that wasn't the seventh game. Like all good presentations, our forum this morning will be divided into three parts, not necessarily equal. First, however, I'd like to introduce Scott Snow, the president of the student body, who's going to address you. Scott?
My remarks this morning will be brief. No respect. What I would like to do this morning is, I would like to talk to Dr. Preuss, actually. Dr. Preuss, would you come up for just a minute? I'm a new president here, and I know that when a new president is in a place, they don't always have a chance to do all the things that they ought to do. You know, they're not used to the job yet. And I know that our president is like that. He's a new president, so he didn't have an opportunity to welcome you to the city of St. Louis, the home of the Cardinals. So I'd like to do that this morning. Several weeks ago when we had a president's forum, there were several things I almost neglected to do, but with Dr. Barth's prompting, I remembered they were things that I should accomplish. I'd like to do the same favor for him, since I think there are probably a few things that he may have forgotten. And that would be to make a presentation on behalf of this seminary, the Student Association, and yea, even indeed, the city of St. Louis. I'd like to present you with a cardinal button that you can wear on your lapel. As I was talking to you this morning, let's see, right side. As I was talking to you this morning and asking about your feelings toward the game, it seemed that there was a little bit of ambivalence. And I hope that as you watch the game tonight, you can just glance down and remember your priorities. Welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Fortunately for him, he didn't tell me what he was going to do up here this morning.
Can I still get a call?
Yeah, I've got a place all picked out for you. Going to be brief in just a couple of things that I would like to report to you about before introducing Dr. Preuss, and we feel very privileged to have him with us today on the campus. One has to do with personnel in terms of our faculty. I'm sure you're all aware of the fact that some weeks ago already, our Board of Regents issued a call to Pastor Richard Kapfer of Ames, Iowa, to be a professor of homiletics and practical department. As yet, we have not heard from him, so we continue to remember him in our prayers. More recently, last Friday, a call was extended to Pastor Ed Schmidt, who lives right here in St. Louis and serves as part of our Board of Mission Services staff. He is the Secretary for Campus and Special Ministries. He has been called as Associate Professor in the Practical Department with appointment as the Dean of Student Life. So you'll want to remember, and we will do this also corporately as well. There's always good news and bad news, and the bad news is, and I think most of you are aware of that already, that Dean Schmiel, who was called to be president of Concordia College in Ann Arbor, has been led by the Spirit of God to accept that call. He announced that last week to our faculty and indicated that he was going to ask for a peaceful release from our Board of Regents, and that was granted to him, regretfully, last Friday. The dean will be with us yet for a couple of months. We're happy about that. And we trust that God, who never makes any mistakes, also has guided him to this decision in the best interests of his kingdom and particularly also of our Ann Arbor Concordia. Dean Schmiel has been very active in setting up our self-study for accreditation, and I want to give you just a brief report on that as well. We will be receiving a visit from the ATS in the fall of 1983. Because of the new presidency, that visit was postponed from spring of 83 to the fall of 83, and the faculty now has been assigned to various subcommittees, and you might be interested in knowing what those subcommittees are. And incidentally, Scott serves as a representative of the student body on the steering committee of our accreditation self-study. But the seven committees deal with the charter and trustees, the whole area of governance and administration. Number two, with respect to the mission and our specific objectives as a Lutheran seminary. Third, the student body and community life. Fourth, academic programs. Fifth, the faculty and teaching, including also our library. Sixth, the graduate school and some other items that are also put into this particular committee's responsibilities. And finally, the seventh committee on finances, facilities, and services. This afternoon, the faculty will be talking some more about the plans of these various committees and the self-study writing that will be going on later on in this academic year in preparation for our visit. When I was in Cambridge a few weeks ago, and you remember I mentioned that at our last forum, I had the privilege of delivering a paper on theological education in confessional Lutheran seminaries in North America. And I spoke also of the, briefly, of the history both of Concordia Seminary St. Louis and also of Concordia Theological Seminary now in Fort Wayne. And when I talked to you about the ministry a few weeks ago, I mentioned the important, in passing, the important role that Wilhelm Lea had in the early history of our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Very dear to my own heart because my grandmother on my father's side was a deaconess under Lea in Germany. And it was through his great help, responding to a call from Dr. Seeler, that the seminary in Springfield was established back in 1846, and just a year later came under synodical control. Then many of you will know that for about 14 years, from the beginning of the Civil War, 1861 to 1875, the so-called theoretical seminary and the practical seminary were combined here in St. Louis and the preparatory work done at Springfield. But then a piece of property was purchased in 1874, and the following year the two seminaries were once more separated. And it is significant that for a large part of the 19th century, the Springfield Seminary produced far more candidates for the office of the pastoral ministry than did our school here in St. Louis. I have some very vivid memories of the history of that seminary prior to its move to Fort Wayne because my sainted father served as president of Springfield from 1945 to 1952. And I remember what to the faculty and staff there was very exciting days just after the war when many veterans who had had a variety of experiences in the war were led to not only to come to Christ but also to serve the Lord in the office of the ministry and came to the Springfield Seminary so that there were all kinds of baby buggies and strange sights that had not been seen on that campus prior to that time. Dr. Preuss, as you know, serves as president of that seminary, which is now moved to Fort Wayne. He served here and is no stranger to Concordia Seminary from 1957 until 1974, and since 1974 has served as president of our sister seminary for 2 years in Springfield and since that time in Fort Wayne. You heard his beautiful chapel homily this morning, and I think it says something about this man who is such a great theologian and yet preaches such a simple and yet marvelous message of the grace of God in the invitation that is given through our Savior. He is no doubt one to whom the church owes a very great debt, one of those heroes during the history of this school some 8 years ago who stood so tall, whose work is not always remembered and, quote, rewarded by the church as it might be, but certainly all of us here at this place know what that role was and how much it meant under God. The fact that we are here today in such numbers is due under the blessing of God to men like Dr. Preuss. I am personally indebted to him as well, not only for his kindness and wise counsel to me during these early days as I serve here in the presidency, but also for all of the theology that one picks up almost by osmosis by simply being near him. Yesterday we attended an ATS symposium down at the Chase Park Plaza, and we had dinner together, and just as he speaks, it seems like theology just oozes out of the man. So it is a great privilege to introduce to you today Dr. Robert Preuss.
Well, thank you very much. I did a lot of counseling to Dr. Barth, and my main counsel, the only that counsel I can remember, was that I urged him very strongly to take the call here, and for very good reasons. I think what the seminary here needs, what any seminary needs in the Lutheran Church, is theological leadership. We need a lot of other things, administration and academics and all the rest, but theological leadership, which I think you're already beginning to see taking place here, is the most important ingredient of all, just as the seminary has to exert theological leadership itself in a church body, which has been done, I think, by this seminary probably more than any other seminary in the history of the world, except maybe the University of Wittenberg when Luther was there. But there is no academic institution which has had such a profound impact upon the life of millions of Christians greater than this institution here. I was asked to speak for just a few minutes, and that's all I'm going to do. And I think it was the topic theological education at Fort Wayne. And I didn't know quite why I should talk about Fort Wayne when I'm in St. Louis, but I think Dr. Barth wanted me to tell you about some of the things we're doing, which may interest you. We're a sister institution. We, I think, are growing closer and closer together in many, many ways as the years go on. And I think to know what the other institution is doing is very helpful for both of us, for students, faculty, and all of us. And my remarks are going to be very random remarks and maybe a little mixed up, but maybe they'll inspire a few questions and comments, and that's the most important thing. I don't think I have any great pearls of wisdom to say to you. Yesterday, Dr. Barth alluded to the fact that he and I were together. Professor Schmiel was there too, a couple of people from Seminex and a few other former graduates of this place. Were also there, quite a few Lutherans from out of a Missouri Synod background were there, discussing a topic entitled Authority in Theological Education Today. Interestingly, after this, or during the meeting yesterday afternoon and evening, we found out that although there were some well-known theologians there, academicians, and I'm sure a few presidents, we could not arrive on a definition of authority. We didn't even know whether there was such a thing as theology. And we couldn't really tell you what education was either after the sessions. In fact, we were unable to determine whether there was a difference between preaching and teaching, and if there was, what it was. Chaos. There was one good speech given. The person who gave the speech was Dr. Barth. Through that welter of darkness, a little bit of light began to penetrate, but very quickly thereafter, they emerged full strong in their speculations again. The second best speech was given by me. I tried to break through this thing by pointing out that education involves, first of all, it's a cognitive enterprise. It really is. Even teaching a child how to ride a bike or teaching some fellow how to pitch a curve does involve cognition. You have to know where the plate is. You have to know the fellow's out there pitching to you and so forth. I didn't get through it all on that. There was little agreement on whether education was really a cognitive enterprise or not. Secondly, I think that education is, among other things, of course, information, especially in your core courses, your survey courses. You're introducing people to a great body of knowledge, information, which they have to have out in the ministry. And even in the skills courses, homiletics, sermon delivery courses, I don't know if liturgics is a skill course or not. Exegesis, some people think it's a skills course. I happen to think so. Others think it's an information course primarily. But even in those skills courses, information is always being imparted. The gospel, we didn't get to this last night, is doctrine. Our confessions talk about the doctrine of the gospel, the teaching of the gospel. And that saving power of the gospel carries out its goal by teaching. It's interesting. I didn't mention this last night because the Bible was sort of out of bounds in the discussion. But if you take the Great Commission, Jesus in one place says, go and preach the gospel, preach. In the other Great Commission text, he says, make disciples by teaching. And so the two are intertwined. They involve each other totally. And I guess even in teaching at a seminary like this, we are preaching the good news. We're certainly doing what preaching ordinarily wishes to accomplish. So I think we're living in a day when the very claim that theology is important and that it's cognitive and that it deals with the truth which God has revealed to us, the truth of the gospel, it's very hard for historic confessional Lutheranism to get through. And if this is the case, then it means that your seminary here and ours in Fort Wayne has a tremendously important mission. Because we are two of the only seminaries in this country which prepare men to go out into the ministry to be preachers and teachers of a message that saves, a message that's true and definite and can be known and grasped by people. In a sense, the confusion that reigned last night, as I saw it, reigned here at this seminary in the early 70s. We couldn't decide on these things, whether there was such a thing as true doctrine, whether Scripture was authoritative in the sense of by nature carrying with it God's authority, in the sense that Paulus dixit means Deus dixit. When Paul speaks, God speaks. When Scripture speaks, God speaks. It was the same problem back in those days. And this seminary emerged from that great affliction stronger, infinitely stronger. We lost a great deal in terms of people, statistics. Many of those, as you know, have been lost permanently as pastors of any church, and certainly as pastors and teachers in the Missouri Synod. But as always, we emerged stronger. And that turned out to be, I think, a great blessing for this seminary. And look at you today. You not only are numerically where you were, but you have, and I say this advisedly, a far, far better faculty and a far better student body. And I think this isn't just the claim of some orthodoxist, but it could be the claim of anybody who came in here, even the ATS, which is coming in a year, and will examine this institution without the criteria that, of course, we would use. So it's a great thing to come back here after just 8 years and see what's happened. And I think we can all thank God for that. Now, another thing that's happened in these last 8 years is that the Fort Wayne Seminary and the St. Louis Seminary have gotten much closer together in a variety of ways, so close that we cannot ever think of competition again, except maybe in the sense of competing that we each send out the best possible pastors. But apart from that, we are being forced by circumstances, and I think by the economy and grace of God, to be more alike every day. Dr. Barth pointed out the fact that from 1861 to 75, the two seminaries were together here, two different types of programs. One, a so-called practical program, where people didn't have all the background, particularly in the biblical languages, and others did, and then they went their separate ways. And when I was teaching here at St. Louis, why, Springfield had a quite a different program. They would get the people that didn't go through the senior college or didn't go through the system, as it was then called, and try to do the best with these people, making preachers out of farmers, pharmacists, businessmen, teachers, and all the rest. Whereas everybody who came here came with a definite background. There was strength in both of these. I think the strength that Springfield might have been the fact that they had a much more heterogeneous, older, wiser student body. The great advantage here, of course, would be that they all had the equipment and the education to handle seminary training and education. With accreditation of the two schools, this school was accredited first, but not long thereafter Springfield was accredited, they were forced to come closer together. And today, I think we are very, very much alike in a number of ways, and I'd like to mention these. By mentioning the similarities, I'll mention also a few differences. We're very much alike in our faculty. There's no point in going into that. We have faculties that are alike, very concerned about doctrine. They could answer these questions that we discussed last night without any hesitation. Faculties that are equally committed to the Scriptures and the Confessions. Faculties who are equally educated. Some 25 years ago, there was not an earned doctorate on the seminary campus at Springfield. Today, we have proportionately probably just as many as St. Louis. Times have changed in that respect. We have the same students today, whereas we didn't before. This is obvious. Beginning before the break in 74, the St. Louis Seminary was taking in students from other institutions than our prep schools. and our senior college. The last year, 1973 and 74, of the teaching administration, there were, I believe, over 30 men in the first year class who had not gone through a Missouri Synod institution to come here. That meant that this institution was forced to do the same as Springfield, namely teach them the Greek and the Hebrew, and forget about Latin and German. It just wasn't even bothered with. And so, in a sense, you were forced here to get into the same type of a situation that we were, and providing some of these pre-seminary courses on the campus. Again, I say it's a blessing and a curse, maybe both, depending on how you look at it. Also, the students became more alike in the fact that your student body, where it was originally all younger men, they might have been married toward the end, but they were all younger, graduating before they were 30. Now you have a student body which is probably just as old as ours. Ours is now 30. Does anybody know what the average age here is? Maybe about 28 or 9. I think you're a little younger than we are still, but we're becoming more and more alike. Okay, faculty is the same. Theology is the same. Student body is getting more and more similar. And the last thing is curriculum. And here, too, we have our differences, but you can't imagine how alike we are. Let me point out a couple of the differences. You demand Hebrew. We urge it and make it a matter of free choice. We're getting to the point where over half our students are now taking the Hebrew track. So we agree with you in your goals. We just feel that since for 150 years, the people going through Springfield didn't have to have the Hebrew, we are still of the opinion that the church would like to see a few pastors who have qualities and yet maybe don't have the Hebrew. So we are not demanding the Hebrew as you do. On the other hand, in some areas we're more stringent than you are. We have a larger curriculum of required courses by far. We teach quite a bit more systematic theology than you do. This may have been due to the fact that at the beginning we had to, because our men came up without any background for the most part. Today we kind of like teaching all that systematic theology, especially since the president is a member of the systematics department, and of course that's the queen. No, I shouldn't say that. Exegesis. We all got to go back to scriptures. The point is that historically we have had a curriculum that requires more hours than you have, and this continues. So there are these differences. I can hardly think of any other differences, and those really are quite minor if you look at them. Fieldwork is the same. I know. I'm pretty much of an expert on this because I've been at both schools. We both have grad schools now. Yours is more in the academic type grad school, academic degrees. We are in the professional type grad school, with the DMIN being our bigger item. But you are going into DMIN now, so again, we're becoming more alike. In continuing education, I'd like to talk about how the two seminaries can work together there. Both of us are doing not nearly enough in it. I'm hoping that both seminaries can do much more. Prerequisites, neither of us demand anything. You get the Greek and Hebrew here if you need it. But the important thing is that we are so much alike as opposed to any other seminaries around. When we were starting our little daughter seminary up in Canada, which is now an independent seminary at St. Catharines, about 35 students this year, not a bad school. The ATS got on our back, that's the Accrediting Association, and they said, why don't you send your students from Canada up to existent Lutheran seminaries in Canada? Little did they know the Missouri Synod mentality. But since, and we were coming up for accreditation, not accreditation, but a visitation, such as you are next year, and I had to answer this question. And they didn't understand things like separatism, unionism, church fellowship, and other things like that. So I looked into Waterloo Seminary, which is right close to St. Catharines, and ordered their catalog. And I found that the overlap of curriculum between that seminary and our seminary, or yours, was no more than 20%. They don't demand exegesis, they don't demand dogmatics, they don't have any symbolics. They may have an elective course, but I'm talking about core curriculum. We have, in other words, grown together, our two seminaries. But so far as the rest of Lutheranism is concerned, or of seminaries of any denomination, we're growing farther and farther and farther away from them. So that it's almost like two different worlds. 20% overlap is all. And that includes fundamental things like homiletics and education and so forth. It is utterly unbelievable. So I guess by talking about our seminary, I'm really talking about your seminary. Really, we're seeing what has to be done. We're retaining our strong emphasis upon exegesis and systematic theology, with the emphasis upon the confessions, which I think tended to save us in this last controversy of ours. And I just think we're both doing the right thing. I think the leadership in terms of our boards of control and our faculties, as they've worked out curricular changes and so forth, has been very excellent. And the interesting thing is that I think theological education is coming back to the more cognitive, informative, structured type of education once again. And these people come in and they examine our two seminaries and they say, what a great school this is. Would that we could have a school like this. This happened. We had the president of Vanderbilt Divinity School. We're talking about fees. You're paying $65 an hour. They're paying $275 an hour at Vanderbilt to go to that seminary as students. Now, maybe they got more scholarships and student aid, but that's what they're paying. Of course, they don't have many courses either. The president came in there, and he examined our school. He talked to the students, the enthusiasm, the interest in theology that they had, and he said, I have never been to a place like this before. This is magnificent. So I think we're doing things right. And I say that the two schools should work together. Your board of control is going to come and visit with our board of control. We try to do this once a year. And together we're going to go into the Synod and make all kinds of memorials, and not demands, but reasonable pleas concerning money, curriculum, manpower, and so forth. And together I think we're going to get the job done and go forward. So, one other thing. As I paint this rather optimistic picture, and I'm an optimist by nature, the Holy Spirit lost my address here at this seminary. I never got a call in 17 years. But I'm glad he did, because then I was around when I could be used with a few other people. And I think that what we have going for us now at the two seminaries is something that is uniquely valuable for our church. I started out this little talk by saying that perhaps no seminary has ever had such a profound impact upon a synod or church body than this seminary here. That impact, that prestige, that leadership role has been greatly tarnished, and that's one place, one area where I don't think you're back to where you were before, and it'll be a while. And I hope that when you do get back to that position of leadership in our synod, we'll be there with you. I think it will happen, but there is no more important vehicle of leadership in a church body than the seminaries. The seminaries are the heart of a church body. We are responsible for you. We're your servants, serving you here while you go out, while you are here training to serve the church. And we will exert our leadership through you as you go out. And I believe that with the type of students we're getting going into the ministry now, and the fine faculties that we have, the church will recognize this leadership that we can provide, and we will go forward very, very steadily and be a great blessing to our church. Now, I don't know if I talked about what you want me to talk about. Maybe you'd like to ask some questions or...
Before opening it up, Dr. Preuss, I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions that may relate either to present day or to your background and your days here from the late 50s. Would it be correct to say, since you emphasize so much the similarities between the two schools, that much of this came about, for good or ill, because of the controversy, in this sense that when this seminary lost the confidence of at least a considerable segment of the church, that many of those who had gone through our prep schools wanted to attend Springfield, and at first didn't really get that permission. They had to sit out. But then when you began to get some of the prep school people, this seminary in turn said, well, then we're going to take some of the non-system people, and that had a lot to do with the bringing together of curriculum and students. Is that a correct historical assessment? Or?
Yeah, you get the point. This is just going back and understanding our history a little bit. I think there's one point I'd like to say by way of clarification, though. This seminary, and I think Dr. Spitz will recognize this fact, actually started that by taking in non-systems students. Once they did that, then the other seminary could turn around and take in systems students. That happened at the New York Convention. And they got permission to take in systems students at the New York Convention in 1967. Once that happened, the two seminaries were in competition with each other for students. And what would happen, of course, would be that the more conservative and sometimes the less able students at the senior college would go to the Springfield Seminary. So you had at the Springfield Seminary some of your worst students and some of your best students from the senior college. And then they got into real competition until, as I said, the last year you really had quite a few non-system students here. I think this seminary lost the confidence of the church with all the fussing around that was going on and all the charges and accusations against some of what the professors were teaching here. They were going out and lecturing and the people would protest it. And so they lost confidence in this seminary and its leadership. They never had much confidence in Springfield. They had always thought of this seminary as the real leader. This seminary had put out their official journals, the Lutheran Witness and the CTM. It was edited by this faculty. This seminary had done all the censorship in the Senate. The other seminary was just sort of out there in the hinterland. So when they lost confidence in this seminary, they lost confidence really in both. And now, coming back, I think we're going to have to earn that confidence. We're not censoring yet. We probably never will censor. We're not issuing the official journals of the Synod any longer. The CTCR has been invented because they didn't have confidence in this seminary. And I guess my claim is that now that we are back on our feet and are showing the kind of orthodox leadership that is, I think, as fine as what you might have had in the days of Pieper, the church should trust us with this leadership once again, which we can provide far better than any other vehicle, like a group of pastors that censor, or a group of people, laymen and pastors, who operate with a CTCR and really have to farm out their stuff to our theologians to get done anyway.
Okay, you want to just field the questions?
If there are any comments or questions. You know, if you guys went to another seminary, you'd appreciate what you got here. Really. I mean, those fellows last night, they didn't. Oh, I was at the ATS meeting. Your president wasn't there. Were you? No, Klotz? Somebody was there. 3 days they were there. Not once when they were there
Now, these were about 250 presidents of theological schools. Not once while we were there was the atonement of Jesus Christ, the work of Jesus Christ, which is, of course, the message of the gospel, ever mentioned as that which was the mission of the church and, obviously, of the seminaries. Not once was the fact that you students are to become ambassadors for Christ, that you are ministers of reconciliation, of the gospel. Not once was that ever mentioned at that group. Now, admittedly, that group has Jews in it. So you might have thought they might have been a little embarrassed to do it. But goodness sakes, they are representing millions of nominal Christians, but they've lost their direction. And those people who are going to those schools, I'll guarantee you, don't study theology. They don't even believe that pure doctrine is a possibility. So all I got to say is it might be good for you just to go and sit in for a week at one of these other institutions and see what you've got here, because you are being prepared to become pastors and ministers of the gospel. You're going to offer people things that are going to save them forever. And I'm just afraid that the world, not just our country, not just Lutheranism, the world needs these two seminaries and the men that these seminaries are sending out. So I'm glad that you seem to be smiling and happy with your lot here, because you better be. You don't know how good you got it. Yes, sir.
In danger of expressing my naivety, if the Lutheran theological seminaries are not teaching as their core curriculum the confessions and systematics and exegesis, what is the core curriculum then at a Lutheran theological seminary?
It's mostly courses in the area of psychology and sociology, particularly sociology. It's hard to know what is actually taught in the classrooms, because all I could read was the course description in the catalog. But there was no course description. There was only one course description up at this one that I looked at that could be construed as dogmatics. There was nothing in symbolics at all. In exegesis, you can take either Greek or Hebrew. But I'm afraid it's more or less like passing a French exam for a master's degree at the University of Minnesota. You know, you bone up for it, pass the exam, and then never use it in class. I mean, that's the Greek and Hebrew. When you're using the historical critical method, you tend to offer the students conclusions. You don't tend to lead them into the text to teach them how to be an exegete. At least that's been my finding. One professor whose name shall be anonymous, when he taught here back in 57, was probably the toughest professor they had in Hebrew. He really threw it at him. In 74, when Seminex walked out, he was teaching courses in Old Testament where the Hebrew text wasn't even brought to class. During that time, he had turned into a higher critic. So your languages and the necessity of the languages and the value of the languages goes down in proportion as the theology goes down. On charismatic gifts, I can get to that one pretty easy, because I think on that we probably agree with this seminary. We have taught exactly what the CTCR has said on it. In fact, the CTCR documents were written by Howard Tepker, who's a member of our faculty. We've perhaps differed from this seminary a few years ago in that we, for better or worse, I think it was better, Dr. Bowman thought it was worse, we thought that it might be well to have a policy that was made known to the students, so that when they came, they knew how it would be handled if they were charismatic or thought they were charismatic. A lot of people think they are, and they're not. I don't think they really are. At least not in the sense of being Schwärmer. So I don't think there'll be any problem there. I might say that right now, because we took our lumps when Larry Neeb sent our statement to the United Press, I got 400 letters from irate charismatics. 400. Was I busy? And if you think charismatics are loving people, I'll show you some of these letters. The liberals haven't ever gotten after me as bad as the charismatics did. Be that as it may, that's our position. We've been very, very blessed by this. We get a lot of people in who have charismatic tendencies, who have been exposed to the charismatic movement. We've had several who have been converted as adults through Assembly of God preachers who have started to read their Bible, became Lutheran because they thought we were biblical, and then came to the SEM, and everything works out just real well. I don't think we have lost a student because he's a charismatic. We've lost two or three charismatics, but because they were incapable of being pastors also on other grounds. So we've been very blessed by that, and for that reason I think that by taking a, not a hard stand, but an honest stand, we probably were blessed. In terms of women's suffrage, some time ago, some congregations wrote in to our exegetical department and asked for what they call a Gutachten, an opinion, whether the Bible, whether according to the scriptures, women's suffrage in the church was right or wrong or indifferent. Our exegetical department wrote this Gutachten in good faith. You do that when people ask you for an opinion. And a resume of it was written up in our magazine, the Springfielder, I think, at that time. And we've gotten a certain amount of response to that, not a great deal. About 20 to 25 people have written me over the last 6 years, maybe, and asked about this opinion, and I just sent it on to them. Recently, this opinion of the exegetical department was summarized by the systematics department. And the systematics department, as you might expect, agreed with their conclusions, but thought that their exegesis was no good. And so they wrote a new, the exegetes wrote a new opinion, which I noticed got into Christian News. So somebody must have leaked it. And that opinion is a little better, I think. It's a little more winsome and doesn't bring in a lot of Bible passages, which probably are irrelevant. That's about where we're at. Dr. Bowman has written me a letter. I might as well, your president's so honest with you, I might as well be honest too. He's written us a letter and said, what about this? Because in Denver, our synod said that you could have women's suffrage in congregations under certain circumstances. And sometimes these circumstances are met in our congregation, sometimes they're not. But be that as it may, I wrote him back and told him just what I've told you and said that maybe the best thing we could do would be to bring this issue to our colleagues at this seminary, especially the exegetes who could look. And you know, don't judge our exegesis, but judge whether our conclusions are correct. You may have much better exegesis. And then bring it to the CTCR, which would be the orderly way of doing it. So that's about where we're at. I think we probably don't have more than one or two or maybe three or four men in our entire SEM who are not against woman suffrage in the church. Again, I might as well tell you that. So although it's picking up all through the synod, our particular faculty is not very much in favor of it. Yes, sir.
How would you relate that practically in the congregational setting? Would a change of position cause any change in what we do in our congregation? I guess it would somehow.
Well, we've had a few of our men, and this is what got Dr. Bowman a little bit upset, who have gone out and tried to get rid of woman suffrage the first thing. And Dr. Bowman lectured us on that at the two seminaries. He called that majoring in minors. And I happen to agree with him. I think it's a very unfortunate thing that if that's the first thing you start going after when you get to a new congregation. I wouldn't even be in favor of going out after lodge members or other things. I think first things have to come first when you go out. I had a son, some of you know him, Rolf Preuss, his name is. He's carrying on the good name. He just had his fourth and fifth son last couple weeks ago. He was concerned because he got called to a congregation in Minnesota that, first of all, had an un-Lutheran hymn book, and secondly, the woman's suffrage. I said, oh, promise me one thing, Rolf, that you don't do anything about either of them for a year. So he didn't. And without doing anything, the hymn book's gone because he just picked good hymns. So now they're going back to the hymn book. And the woman's suffrage thing, it'll settle itself. He doesn't have to get uptight about it. So I think it's how you handle it. Yes?
What's your position on the merger of the three churches and then the practical implications for us at the congregational level?
I'm ecstatic about it. I think it's great, especially for the AELC. Isn't it fine that they can finally find a church home? You've probably heard this story that Ralph Bowman tells, but cousin David Preuss, he's president of the... by the way, they called me David Preuss at your installation. Anyway, David has predicted... And, of course, anybody can predict something for 2000 when he knows he's going to be dead before that happens. That we're going to be joining this new church body in 2000. And, of course, Ralph Bowman, he didn't let that go by. He said something. And then he asked David, he told David, hey, we opened up 81 new mission congregations and 101 new missions this last year. How many did you open up in the ALC? Six. And then Ralph missed it. I told him, you should have said, look, you'll be joining us in 2000. Figure it out according to the actuarial tables. We'll be bigger than they are. They're losing membership. Gross numbers still. The LCA is losing it a lot. It's as Ted Radke used to say, when churches cease to grow, they seek to unite. Same with big business. Yeah?
Can you please comment on the growth and development of the Hispanic program on your campus?
Well, here's something I was going to talk about. Namely, that I think the way the two seminaries are going today with very, very similar programs, I think it is a great mistake what we were vying for about 6 years ago, that the Hispanic program go to Fort Wayne, or that it go to St. Louis, or that St. Louis cater to the blacks and we cater to the Hispanics. No, I think we should all cater to everybody. And I might say that at our particular seminary, we've got Garcia, which gives us an edge on you in that respect. He can teach courses in homiletics using the Spanish medium and other courses, and he does so. We're doing well in terms of our Anglos being either coming there, wanting to go into Hispanic work, or deciding to go into it after they get there and learning sufficient Spanish. We have a pretty near a full-time teacher of Spanish there in addition to Garcia. So we have a large number of Anglos going into that work. If I could say so, not too many Hispanics. And the trouble is, you see, we don't have too many Hispanic Lutherans. And those that we do have, the younger ones, are not educated, and it's going to take a while before we can get that type of a person into our ministries. So we're going to have to be satisfied, I think, with an awful lot of Anglos. But now in our ministry, here's another area where I think neither St. Louis nor Fort Wayne should have the edge. I think they should both go into full-time, and that's in your ministry to the deaf and handicapped. We now have George Krause. You have a Corny here. We used to call him Pogo when I was a professor here. It's so much fun to have been the teacher of some of your professors, some of ours too. Anyway, there is so much to be done in both these areas that it would be a crime if one seminary alone did it. And we are now going to educate, we hope, three times as many people in the deaf language as will ever be using it out there full time. I just got taken to the plane yesterday by a fellow that's going into deaf work. He's very proficient, but he's not going to get a call to a deaf congregation. He's going to go up to North Dakota or someplace, and then he will be the central pastor in a circuit or two or three and get these people in rather than have one deaf pastor for the whole state of North Dakota. That's the way it's been in the past. And I think we should do the same thing in Hispanic work. These Germans who came over here, they ministered to their people in German, and then they learned the English so they could minister to the younger in the English. Okay, that's right. Now we find 15 million Hispanic people, and we got no language. We don't know the language to deal with the older folks. And so I think that you ought to have maybe 35 guys a year who can handle the Hispanic language, at least Spanish, at least to the point where they could communicate to these older folks who prefer it and maybe can't even speak English very well. But that doesn't mean that they got to go into some Hispanic community in Harlem or Chicago or someplace. These are my feelings on it, and I'm optimistic about it, but it's going to take time.
Yes.
Could I just have...
Who's Professor Graff?
1 minute.
Emeritus professor at the Springfield Seminary. Alumnus of this seminary.
I'm just here by accident. And yet, as a Christian, I know I'm not here by accident, but by the Lord's guidance. And I just can't help but stand up and praise the Lord for being here this morning. You don't know how good it is for an older man like me to be here on this occasion to see these two presidents together, not just walking arm in arm physically, but theologically. See, I graduated from this seminary in 1937. It was really wonderful to be here at that time. And I became a professor at Springfield in 1954. And it was just wonderful to be there at that time. But then came the late 60s and the 70s, and we had some joint faculty meetings on which I'm not going to expand. I was always happy that this good brother was here on the St. Louis Seminary at that time. But those were rather sad days. I was a little farm boy. I loved the church and I loved Christ. And it was just such a tremendous thing that by the grace of God, He chose me to be a minister. And then later that by His grace, He made me a professor. But it was a very sad thing to see the things happen in the church that happened. And I just can't tell you how good it is to be back here and to see these two presidents of these two seminaries together the way they are, doctrinally, theologically, with their love for Christ and their love for people. And I'm convinced that the greatest day for our church are ahead. Don't forget to pray for your two seminary professors, your seminary presidents. I believe that's one mistake that we made in our day. We took a lot for granted. We had such wonderful professors at that day, Dean Fritz, Dr. Engelder, Dr. Spitz, who's still sitting here with us, Dr. Rares, just tremendous and wonderful men, but we more or less took them for granted. And my plea is that you don't make that mistake, but regularly take them to the Lord in prayer, all your professors and your church. I know both of these men personally. They're tremendous men. And I can still recall one trip that I made with Dr. Preuss when I was professor at Springfield and he was professor here. He was to deliver a paper at Okoboji, which was a rather basic paper he wanted to deliver. And we were driving in a car from, I don't know how that happened exactly, that we got together in a car and we were driving up and he was driving. And at the same time, he was trying out his paper on me. And he was getting really enthusiastic about that paper. And we had to make a turnoff from a highway that ran from east to west to go north. And he was getting so enthusiastic about that paper, we missed a turnoff. But then, of course, on the freeway, you had to go maybe 8, 10, 15 miles before we could turn around. We came back, we missed it again. So he may not be too good on driving highways, and I don't know about Dr. Barth, but the two certainly know the road theologically. And praise the Lord for this daily. And my prayer is that the Lord will continually bless both of these seminaries, bless these two men who head them up. And again, I just can't tell you what a thrill it is to be here this morning, to be in chapel and to hear that wonderful address and to hear all these remarks here this morning. God bless the two presidents, bless all of you men. We need you. The Lord needs you and men like you out in the church everywhere. We can even use some of you in Texas.
I want to say a couple words about this man. He told you that he was at the Springfield Seminary when I was here. I think that he did more to build up the evangelism interest at our two seminaries and any other man in recent times. That's one of the things he taught at Springfield over the years. At the same time, we were trying to teach evangelism here, but it wasn't going too well. And I think you and I went out, didn't we, a few times with Radeke on some of these evangelism workshops. And what he did, I think, at that school still is being greatly and deeply appreciated. So I know that you've gotten into the groove now with your professor of evangelism over there, so things are fine at both seminaries. But we owe him a great deal of thanks for this great emphasis, which we didn't have so much of in our church some time ago. I think it's time to leave.
All right, we got maybe 3-4 minutes. If there are any other, were there some hands up that weren't? Please, Dr. Preuss, if you don't mind.
Question both to you, Dr. Barth, and to Dr. Preuss. I'd like you to comment on what's being done at both seminaries in response to the mission challenges adopted by the Synod and Convention in 79.
Please.
If you would.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I had intended to mention that. This is no secret that Dr. Westcott has worked out a plan. It's not thoroughly worked out yet, but the plan thus far means this, that each seminary is to call a man in the whole missions area, which of course includes church growth, evangelism, special ministries, and all of it. That man is to be seconded or used by the mission board as they please up to half of the time each year, and they will pay
either half or all of his salary. All the details haven't been worked out yet. We already have the man, our new Professor Bunkowski. And he will be heading up our evangelism, our missions program. I think it's going to grow tremendously under his leadership. He is a tremendous fellow. And I've already told Dr. Barth that I hope that your seminary can get a parallel person like this and do your thing. You can call it an evangelism school, a program, a department. That doesn't matter. What matters is that everybody at this school gets into this matter. Whether he goes out in the foreign field or not makes no difference. And we're working hard on it with Dr. Westcott, trying to push through any curricular, not changes, but additions that we have. I frankly would hope that in the next triennium, both seminaries would have two men in this area so that all the bases can be covered. Dr. Bunkowski right now is seeing it that it's necessary to teach more courses, say nothing about all the other things he's doing, than he can teach. And he hasn't been there more than 6 weeks. So we have tremendous potential here. And if Bowman is right that we're opening up 100 new missions right in this country, and if Westcott and the board is correct, we hope that they're going to be sending 60 missionaries abroad of all kinds each year for the next 10 years, which of course isn't being done yet, but that's still their hope. That's 160 vacancies a year that we're going to have to fill, one way or the other, from our two seminaries. That means that there's going to be calls for you people. Maybe not in Milwaukee, but somewhere.
And to that, I can add that just day before yesterday, I spent a couple of hours with Dr. Westcott, and that was number one item on the agenda. And he's planning, and I mentioned this to Dr. Preuss yesterday, for a consultation that would involve his people and hopefully BPS and both seminaries to implement this and see once what can be developed with regard to it, because it is much more, as Dr. Preuss hinted, than simply teaching courses. But to develop among all the students, whether they're going overseas, whether they're going to some special ministry in this country or not, a deeper mission consciousness so that all of us realize what it is that God has given us to do. And having a person with that particular responsibility, we feel, will be a big help, and perhaps hopefully even more than one. So it is kind of top shelf on our priority, and we have already incidentally begun a search and of people and names in consultation with the Board for Mission Services as well to have a man. Fort Wayne got a good head start there, and we're thankful that they have a man on board already. We hope we will as well. Well, Dr. Preuss, it's really been great to have you here, and it's my privilege, as you know, in May to speak at the graduation of the graduation ceremonies at the Fort Wayne School, and we're looking forward to paying them a visit November 19-20, as he indicated, when our Board of Regents will be holding both individual and separate meetings to discuss our common concerns. We're looking forward, as God grants grace, to wonderful days of working together with our common role and our common commitment to the Scriptures and the Lutheran Confessions. He said something about being gone 40 days out of the first 70 or something like that. And so it's even more kind of him to take in this extra morning to visit us here. Let's let him know that we are grateful.